today, it's my conversation with Janet Maher. Janet Maher is one of the founders of the mental health consumer movement in Australia. She's a former CEO of the New South Wales Consumer Advisory Group. She's been a Churchill Fellow, an author, an advocate, and also a board member and secretary of the World Federation for Mental Health. And she's come a long, long way. In her 20s, Janet had a breakdown, and she was diagnosed with schizophrenia. Janet spent a decade in Gladesville Mental Hospital in Sydney. Gladesville is now closed. Janet's story comes from a time when mental health issues were poorly understood and patients were hospitalised and often abused. But now in her 60s, Janet Maher has a loving family, an Order of Australia, and a remarkable career behind her. For a long time, Janet rarely spoke in detail about her time in Gladesville, simply because for many years no one would believe her. The truth about what happened to her and other patients is what made her a leading advocate for the mental health consumer movement. Janet, you've got an ironing board at home. You've had for a while now. It's the most important ironing board in the world as far as you're concerned. Tell me what that means to you, that ironing board.
Most people have an ironing board. Mine rarely gets used, but this particular one is a bit of an icon. This ironing board is something, the only thing that I have that's travelled with me into my recovery. It was something which was purchased as part of my rehabilitation. In my last years at Gladesville, they had a program whereby we were to become rehabilitated in order for there to be a model for deinstitutionalisation that we could use in Australia. This was in the very late 70s, and they picked some patients from the long stay ward, and I was that lucky soul. We were brought into this rehabilitation thing, and it was horrendous to me.
Why?
Because these were all people I saw as well, and I was a person who wasn't, and that's a ridiculous assumption, but that's how I saw it.
So what task were you given then as part of this deinstitutionalisation?
We all had to, it was called domestic retraining, and that's exactly what it was. We had to learn how to cook, how to clean, how to behave in a real world environment, and they tried to get me to behave as a normal person in that small environment, which didn't work very successfully, I must add. However, they were determined to make it successful, so they were determined to have me conform. Eventually I did.
So how did you get the ironing board?
Well, this was part of the program. Once I learnt to conform to what was required of me in the domestic retraining, and they helped us learn to cook and clean and all those things you need as a normal person, supposedly, they decided that we were sophisticated enough to take out into the general public. So they took a lot of us out to prepare by purchasing household goods, to prepare for a life in a normal flat like other people live. And we were going to move into this flat in the community with support, and we needed all the goods and chattels that people need when they move out. So we were taken to Grace Brothers at Top Ryde, and the person in charge gave us tasks to undertake. I was given the task of finding an ironing board.
Were you confident you could do that after 10 years in Gladesville?
I thought I could, but I couldn't, because I'd not been in one of the self-serve type department stores previously. And this was a self-serve type department store. And I thought, now, where would you find an ironing board? And perhaps you'd find it in furniture, because it's a piece of furniture you put up and you put ironing on it and you iron. So I looked in the furniture department and there was no such thing. I thought it might be kitchenware, because you often iron in a kitchen. So I went through the kitchenware department and couldn't find an iron. So eventually we found an iron. I was given a lot of help to find an ironing board, sorry. And in finding the ironing board, I was thrilled. And so I went back to the staff member who was with us and said, I found the ironing board. She said, oh, good, you're almost the last. I'll pay for it now. And she came up to the checkout where this ironing board had been, and she pulled out this little piece of plastic. And I said, you have to pay for it. And the woman started wrapping it up. And she said, I'm going to pay for it with this. And I said, no, you'll need money, you know. And it was the first time I'd ever seen a credit card being used. It was a bank card. And she paid for it with no money. It was just absolutely amazing. I knew they existed. I'd never seen one. You know?
And you still have that ironing board today.
I have that ironing board today. And I got rid of the iron about 10 years ago. But the ironing board is still my ironing board. It's one wheel less. You know, it had a wheel on it, but it's gone. But it's still there and it still does the job if ever I was needing to iron.
Do you love that ironing board?
In a weird way. In a weird way. I don't love it for what it means, the work, but I love it for what it symbolises. It was the item I chose. We meant we could go out and live in a community.
The story of how the whole lead up to that buying that ironing board is, and your life is a very big story, Janet. Let's start with Newcastle. You were born in Newcastle. Were you born into a working class family in Newcastle?
I'd say lower working class. Yes. My dad worked at BHP. He worked as an assistant in the furnaces, which were in the BHP in the late 40s, early 50s, the jobs were not very reliable. There was a lot of strikes. So there were more times than not that we actually had no income in the household because of the strikes and so on and the safety concerns in the BHP factory in Newcastle.
This status you had, as you say, lower working class, that was hard for your mum to accept.
Oh, mum, yes. Mum really had great desire to be famous, social, and in the inset, and everything in our lives screamed at that being utterly and entirely impossible. She had this desire to be a glamorous woman, which nobody blames anybody for, but the reality of her own life in her own home with her own family and her own husband was just as far as you could possibly imagine being so distant from that dream. Yet she managed to live this life of her dreams in a wonderfully weird way. She would hear that there was a ball on or something in Newcastle Town Hall. If it was at the Town Hall, you know, you really made it if you're invited to something there. So Mum would get herself involved with any organising committee or anything that needed someone to arrange flowers or to do some activity to get herself there. And so she would go to the ball or the dinner or the supper or the whatever the social event was. She had a great need to be in those scenes.
How did she get the clothes to wear to the ball? How did Cinderella clothe herself for that one?
Oh, Cinderella was extremely clever. Those ladies in the audience who are old enough to remember or young enough to have those memories would probably remember that you could go to the best clothing shops, the best dress shops, and if they were really good ones, really nice boutique ones, they would allow you to take a piece of clothing home to try on with your accessories, etc. Well, Mum was a great trier-onner of elegant frocks, and Mum had the best frocks that were ever produced in Australia, but she usually only had them for less than 12 hours. She would go to these shops as dressed up as she could get, take them home on spec, and then get us kids, we had little pad things we used to sew into armpits and things like that, would take the sweat, you know, from when you're under pressure. Then as soon as she'd come home, she'd wake one of us up and say, take them out, and we'd unsew these, you know.
What do you mean as soon as she came up? What, like at 1 in the morning or something?
It doesn't matter when, you know, because the dress then had to be aired before it was taken back. You know, so the dress would be hung on the back veranda to air so that, you know, personal odours and cigarette odours and things would go from it. Then it would be pressed in the morning, and us kids used to take it back and say it wasn't suitable.
What did your dad think of your mum's aspirations to be a fine lady?
He just let it all slide over the top of him, because as far as he's concerned, it was all crazy, and if she wanted to do that, well, she could do it.
Were you kids tying her down from her lofty aspirations?
Very much so. Mm. We were obviously not always the best behaved children in the world, but we were pretty close to it, I think, because we were terrified.
Why were you terrified?
Oh, she was... Part of the thing that she had was that everyone had to be how she saw them to be, and there was no options allowed.
Well, how did she enforce that? Was she violent?
Extremely. Extremely violent.
To all of you?
Yes. With the exception of my younger sister, who came along several years later, probably a totally different generation. She didn't experience this at all, whereas the three of us who were older definitely each had equal share.
What did you make of that? You couldn't have had any perspective on that as a kid, Janet, could you? You couldn't have seen how strange that all was, could you?
I knew we were different. I knew we were incredibly different to other kids. Other kids didn't have welts all over them. They could sit in their school chair, you know, and not hurt. Their clothes were often cleaned and ours weren't. They got new clothes sometimes. We didn't. So I knew we were very different. I did think it was because you were poor, I must admit, but I was very, very confused about some things that I saw as really cruel, really unnecessary and unjustified, but I had this strict sense of justice that never seemed to ever play at home. It was always, if you misbehave, all of you get a belting, or if I catch you first, you're the one who's going to get thrashed.
What do you think was going on with your mother anyway? What do you think that's all about?
I really believe she didn't cope with life at all. I mean, in those times, you had child after child after child. She was living in absolutely extreme poverty from time to time. She really did aspire to something much more than life in suburban Newcastle probably could have offered her. And it was just, now that I look at it, it was incredibly sad to live a delusional life. But I'm somewhat comforted by the fact that later on in life she found a bit of peace, or was able to contribute to other people's security and happiness.
How? But,
well, as I said, after she had my younger sister, she was more moderate, and she was at that time nursing my father, who was incredibly ill and end up dying. And she was mellowed. I don't know what happened. I suspect she got some help. I suspect she had some medication or something, but we were never told about that. I do remember some pills around the house, which I now recognise as being some that at that time you would have used for mood disorder, but I don't know that for a fact.
How did you escape?
I escaped by having a scholarship and getting to Sydney after I finished my schooling. So I came to Sydney, and my aunt had a boarding house, and I lived with her and had a reasonably stable life there.
You're happy? Was it? Did you feel released?
I felt very released, but in a way, like you've heard of the Stockholm syndrome, where a hostage misses
and
has affection for the captor. Well, I felt a bit like that, with the freedom and with the lack of emotional whirlpools happening around me. I did feel somewhat emotionally confused, because there was no need to, you know, I suppose it's the old fight and flight thing. I was not under stress anymore. and found it really hard to live with a balance in my life.
So you've grown up with stormy waters all your life, yes. And the ocean has be calmed, and you don't know, what is this? This is weird.
And you're waiting all the time. is someone going to do something, or is something going to happen here? And then you realise, no, that's how people are. You know, that was a bit difficult, really.
So you were becoming, at quite a young age, you became a teacher, didn't you?
Oh, yes. I was out. I'd done my first year teacher training, and I was out the next year teaching. And at that time, I was the only trained teacher in a fairly large primary school. So after school, we used to have classes for the teachers sometimes, where I'd teach them some of the stuff I learnt at Teachers College. And then in that second year, you had to also do assignments and part-time work at college and things like that.
So that was all good, but you left.
I was 16 years of old.
You were 16 years of age, doing all this very grown-up work. I'm in my 40s. I don't think I'm cut out to do that kind of work. But but you left. Tell me, why you left is very interesting. Tell me what happened, Janet.
Well, after a few years of teaching in that environment, and I was a pretty reasonable teacher and very experienced, I decided to run off and join a nunnery.
Why?
I really felt I had a calling to that life. I felt, I know that's very, that seems so pithy, but I just felt that I could make a difference in people's lives through being more committed myself.
Was it a road to Damascus type thing, or was it more some kind of swelling conviction within you, Janet?
No, it wasn't a road to Damascus. In fact, it was a road that I'd looked at and refused on several stages of my life up until that period in my 20s, beginning of the 20s. And I just decided that I shouldn't just keep ignoring the fact that I thought that would be a more fulfilling life for me, so I decided that was going to be it. I'll give it a go.
How did you like life in the convent?
I really thought it was what I had anticipated. I realised it was something that gave depth to all the things I had enjoyed doing. It was, in another way, limiting, but that limiting was okay. And a lot of young people who went into religious life at that time found it terribly restrictive, but having had a fairly restrictive upbringing, it was not anything unusual.
Convent was like Luna Park compared to your childhood,
was it? It really wasn't anything terribly challenging for me. And I really enjoyed a period of contemplation and a period of being able to look at life from a more fulfilling perspective.
Do you think your peace, your peacefulness, do you think that would have been, that was safer behind the convent wall? Did you think that was part of your thinking then?
Definitely not. Although I look at it now and I think, was it just a period that was to give me something else to help me through the next period of my life? I think whatever it gave me at that time in my life, it did give me an ability to contemplate and be cognizant of things in a way that I probably hadn't had previously, and that certainly has helped me in my recovery.
After a while, you were called back to your family. What had happened?
As I mentioned, my mum had been looking after my dad, who developed really serious health problems as a result of his work, and at 58 he died. But before he died, Mum, in the month or so before he died, Mum had a very, very serious series of heart attacks and was not capable of caring for him when his needs were so great. The convent released me and let me go home. I was able to nurse both Mum and Dad, and eventually Dad died, and I looked after my sister and my mother for a period of time until their life settled down a bit after Dad's death. And at that time, Mum was a lovely, benign person, so it was a bit like chalk and cheese. You couldn't see that woman as being the one that had been before. So it was a little bit of a pleasant time, really, but I was very wary, very wary.
Did you resent your mum being so pleasant? I mean, did you think to yourself, I mean, you've only been human, Janet, to think, gee, I could have done with a bit of this milk of human kindness when I was a kid.
I used to often feel that with my younger sister, that she was always nice to my younger sister. I always found that quite difficult. And in fact, I was one of the mothers that my younger sister had. She had mum who pandered to her, and that's not negative to her, it was the way mum was. And then she had me, who I had to be the disciplinarian and the parent who gave her boundaries, whereas mum hadn't been. But as she grew up to be a lovely human being, and so she avoided a lot of the stuff the rest of us had to deal with.
What brought on your first episode of schizophrenia?
In a word, I think trying to disconnect from the emotional garbage of my life, but in a process, my older brother and sister both were going through seriously important life changes, and mum had chosen to reject both of them at that point. When they most needed somebody, mum had decided to revert to the self that we knew, and was terribly, terribly offensive to both of them. I was the one that was trying to act as a go-between in the family, and in that go-between stage, I found myself torn between the need to get some sort of conciliation and the need to try and have my mother see them as her children and needing a mother's love, not condemnation. On Christmas Eve of 1969, I think, my sister came to see me, and she was to deliver a letter from mum to my brother, and the next day I was to take something back to mum in Newcastle. And my sister asked to look at the letter, which we both read. It was absolutely the most offensive piece of writing I think I could have ever read, and I said, I don't think I could ever give that to my brother. I don't think you should give it to him. And we had this conversation. Yeah, it was really grossly offensive and so hurtful that no human being would have ever been able to deal with that. And my sister said I left the room and said I'd come back in a minute. Well, I never came back.
Where did you go?
I don't know where I went immediately. I have no idea where I went immediately, but obviously I'd had what used to be called euphemistically a nervous breakdown. That was probably the last straw. I went off, did something or other, but later that night I was in my beautiful nunwear, nightwear, which would have been quite fetching, I'm sure.
A nun's nightie.
Yes. And I stole a convent car and drove to the international airport and was found after having driven right into the arrivals lounge of the airport. That's how it's been reported to me.
What, do you know if you were injured?
I don't believe I was injured. I imagine the car was fairly injured and the airport was probably relatively injured as well. Today I would have been shot, which might have ended a lot of my problems, I suppose, but at that time I wasn't shot, and apparently I was taken to a psychiatric hospital whereby they tracked who I was.
You have no memory of that episode?
I have no memory at all.
When do memories kick in then after that?
The first thing I remember is waking in a wet bed, so obviously I'd not been in control of my facilities, in the hospital, in a psychiatric hospital, a private one, and I could hear things before I could see things, and I could hear my mother's voice shouting at somebody, "What have you done to my daughter? Tell me what you've done to my daughter." And I found out later she was talking to the nun in charge of my convent, and she was quite distressed by that because she said to me I couldn't answer her.
And what were you thinking?
I knew what I was thinking. And even though I was probably as mad as a two-bob watch, I was thinking, what have you done to your daughter? You know, and your son and your other daughter, you know?
You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio and the World Wide Web.
Today you're hearing the story of Janet Marr. Janet was diagnosed with schizophrenia when she was a young woman, and for 10 years she was a patient in Gladesville Mental Hospital in Sydney. For many years since then, Janet has been an advocate for the mental health consumer movement. She's a former National Mental Health Commissioner, and she's working with the Independent Advisory Council on the National Disability Insurance Scheme. Janet, you were saying that you woke in hospital somewhere and you were aware that the bed was wet. What did you understand had happened to you?
I had no comprehension whatsoever.
Were you frightened out of your mind?
Absolutely terrified. Absolutely terrified because I'd lost my memory of how I came to be there or what I was doing there. It was scary because I'd never been in such a place. I had no concept of what a psychiatric hospital would look like or be like and why my mother would be there and who would know I was there and even who I was. There was sort of no need for me to know who I was in my mind at that time. I was trying to align the environment to anything I knew and I couldn't.
What were you diagnosed with?
At that time, I don't know what they diagnosed me with. I suspect it was depression. I know at that time there were a lot of people asked me questions about my father's death and so on, and I think there was a presumption that maybe it was a late-onset grief reaction or something like that. But it became really clear to people eventually that it was much more than depression. It had a very strong psychosis attached to it, and there was a lot of paranoia and a lot of self-hatred and a wish to remove myself from that situation.
Was schizophrenia mentioned?
Not in the early stages, no.
Do you think you were schizophrenic then?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I suspect, looking back in my own mental states over years before that, I can see patterns of thinking and thought processes that I now recognise as those fairly common to people with schizophrenia.
Do you mean voices and visions and the like?
No, I wouldn't say that far, but there were definitely paranoid tendencies and ways of thinking that are, to my mind, abnormal. Things that up until that particular point I mentioned, I was able to keep under some sort of control. But in fact, my thought and personal social processes were somewhat flawed when I look back. And that seems to me to be a precursor to the schizophrenia that later developed.
You'd had a breakdown of some kind and a major schizophrenic episode at the airport. Mm. Was that the worst of it?
Oh, no. No, that was easy. That was piece of cake compared to what was to come. It accelerated over time. The private hospitals were quite good. I got functional. I went out there and got another job and had in time left the convent because I was not in a condition to renew my vows. That was really, really traumatic for me. And then I found after multiple trips, many, many trips over probably a 12, 18-month period into psychiatric private hospitals that I had a debt, which was massive by my standards at that time.
What, just incurred by your visits to these hospitals?
Yes.
This is pre-Medicare, obviously.
Yes, and the nuns had paid up my private health insurance to enable me to keep going. But what they didn't know and what I didn't know is that after a certain number of days in hospital at that time, you're no longer eligible. So I'd been racking up bills and so on. So I decided that...
That's outrageous.
I know. I wonder why I became a lobbyist eventually.
There you are suffering a chronic mental illness.
Yes.
And even though you were had private insurance, it just stopped at some point. And too bad, you're a mentally ill person. You're perfectly capable of settling these debts.
Yes.
That's outrageous.
But it didn't worry them. It was just economics. And that's why people who talk economics to me usually find I put a bit of a human thing on it, very violently. So I'd worked a few jobs, and at one stage I had three jobs running at the same time, and there's a big surprise around the corner. I had another breakdown, didn't I? Yes, no one would know why, but I did. And so that was my last attempt, if you like, at trying to lead a normal life.
That was followed by 10 years in Gladesville Mental Hospital. Tell me, just can you describe it as it was then?
It was in the process of being deteriorated. They were trying to run it down. They were realising that the maintenance costs of these large places was extreme. This one had been built in 1836 in colonial era Sydney. The plumbing, electricity and facilities needed expensive maintenance. Those who worked at trying to maintain these large places had a very hard job. The fact is that other types of health had higher priorities, so the monies delivered to the states for mental health often got sidelined to a lesser extent now, thank God, into general health budgets.
Janet, one thing we know, you know, history tells us again and again, if you have a group of people who are unable to defend their rights, those rights will be abused and badly abused. Mm. Patients who are of, I suppose we can use that old phrase, of sound mind are more capable of defending their rights than mental health patients.
Oh, absolutely. Once you got into long-term wards in these places, you become, I don't know what the word is, a chattel, I suppose, of some people, but still respected by others. And those people who are attracted to work in some roles in institutions, most of them are very dedicated, but there's an element that's attracted to work into these places that is exploitative, and there were those people there. I did a survey, a rough, dodgy survey of people who were friends with me or whom I knew in those institutions not long after I left, and I asked them the question, have you ever been assaulted? Have you ever been sexually assaulted? And I only ever met one who claimed never to have been sexually assaulted. One.
And how about you? Are you in the...
Multiple times. You knew you're in for it. You only had to look at the rosters. You only had to look at the rosters. On the rosters, you knew which nurses were coming on duty. If certain nurses were on, and I could name one in particular, even now, and I hope he's listening because I remember you. If, I'll say, this particular nurse was on duty, but there were several, you would get with your medication that evening an extra pill. And you knew what that was for. That pill was to knock you out or make you stupid. And if he was dishing them out, he'd make sure you took them. And he'd check you afterwards to see that you did take them. And often you'd be in what they call seclusion, which is a room set apart in every psych unit. There's usually a seclusion room or two or three, even now, which I think is atrocious. And if you got the extra tablet and you got so-and-so on duty and you were in seclusion, you were the girl for the night. Or the boy.
Was this a case of one or two bad apples amongst the staff, or was this practice widespread?
I think one or two bad apples could spread the disease right through an institution. They only had to be on your ward to do the damage. And if you're there 365 days a year and there are 26 wards, everyone gets a go.
Describe the routine at Gladesville for you as a patient there.
Oh, the routine was very satisfying in a way. You slept in a dormitory, female dormitory. There were bars on the windows. You had one or two blankets and you were reasonably comfortable. If you misbehaved, you're put in men's pyjamas so that you wouldn't escape. If you were good and behaved yourself, you would be woken in the morning and showered. And in the first ward I was in, there were communal showers where there was no privacy at all, and the nurses would inspect you.
Male nurses?
Any nurse, every nurse.
How were you going at that stage?
Oh, it was easier to be mad than to try and get well. It was easier to be a crazy one than to try and face the reality of what was happening and where you were. You'd get up in the morning, you'd be line up and you'd have breakfast and you'd line up and you'd hand your dishes in and you'd line up and you'd have your pills, line up and be sent to a group to discuss something. I hated those groups, hated it with a vengeance because I couldn't communicate. Then you'd line up and go to lunch and then you'd line up and go to something else.
Was it all that bad? Was there another side to life there?
Oh, there was another side, and it was a wonderful side, really. And that's where it's such an enigma, because you've got that side and then you've got this wonderful culture or subculture within the patients and within some of the staff, where there's beautiful places in those grounds. I could take you on a trip and show you lovely spots where certain things happened and people said things and lovely little niches in the gardens. Or
who were some of your best friends from that time? Give me descriptions of some of the people you were with in as fellow patients.
There was Mr. Smith. Mr. Smith was a patient and he had a workshop there with all the horological stuff you could ever want. And he was the watchmaker and clockmaker. And anyone who had trouble with watches or clocks brought them there, and it was a business. He didn't charge except for what it cost him. And he had a roaring business, and he took a personal interest in all the patients that used his services. There was also Mr. McKenzie. Mr. McKenzie, Keith R. McKenzie, wrote the hospital bulletin, the news sheet, and it had all the gossip in there and all the progress and so on in various parts of the hospital. There was another lady who ran the bank in the canteen. So you could actually have a Commonwealth Bank branch in the canteen, and she was a patient and she was a wonderful woman. And I still know her quite well.
And the staff, you spoke earlier about certain staff members who committed sexual abuse of some of the patients.
Yeah.
Were there other more compassionate people there?
Oh, there were absolutely wonderful people there. Really kind, helpful social workers, nurses, chaplains. The list is endless of the wonderful people, and it's really bad, I suppose, that I'm only mentioning the negative ones. There was one guy, Fred, and he was forced to special me, and anyone who's been in these places would know what specialing means. It means you got to keep that person safe. I was about 16 stone, if that's being very kind to myself. He was about 7 stone, and his job was to keep me safe. Poor Fred. Now, Fred was an absolutely wonderful human being. He put his job at risk so many times to see that I had support, human touch. And there were many things Fred was able to do that were just unbelievably touching and human. And if I spoke about that now, I'd burst into tears, because there's some beautiful stories of what Fred did to help me.
Did you try and escape?
All the time. I was the great escapologist of Gladesville.
What does that mean? Did you have to climb over walls and what?
What it meant was you had to get out of the locked offices or the locked wards or the locked building, and you had to make good your escape wherever you could. Many's the time, either physically or metaphorically, you try to escape. Now, physically means you get out the locked door as soon as someone opens it, and you doesn't matter what you do to push them over or whatever to get out. Then you'd run out onto Gladesville Road and jump in front of a bus or a truck and hope they'd kill you or something like that. But it was a highly unsuccessful technique, as you can see, because I'm here and I never got hit by a bus or a truck, but I traumatised many. The other way is, of course, to try and get yourself out by removing yourself from life.
Did you try that?
Oh, multiple times. And I won't even begin to discuss methods that I chose to do that, but again, highly unsuccessfully, some of which were relatively more successful than others. But suicide really isn't a great option, because what you're trying to do when you try to suicide is remove yourself from an inescapable situation. And sometimes we don't realise that life is bigger than that situation. And I found that, and I thank God every day that I was not able to access an appropriate means, and I was able to find that life had value because I was able then to use my experience to try to change systems that enabled dreadful things to happen.
So within this awful life, I don't know how you ever got it. How did you come to actually convince the authority? Yeah, escape successfully, legally, I suppose. How did you convince the authorities that you were okay? And were you okay? I mean, what happened to you, Janet?
I wasn't okay, and I still am not. But what I am is I'm more possessed of my own recovery. I mentioned in passing when you were talking about the ironing board, I mentioned that I was part of a rehabilitation program. I was placed in that program basically to fail it, to sink it. The nurses' union at the time did not want deinstitutionalisation to happen.
So this is the late 70s we're talking about,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes.
And there was a movement afoot to sort of deinstitutionalise people with mental illnesses.
Yes. And this experiment of domestic retraining and replacing people in the community was meant to show that it could work for whoever. And I was...
Well, I remember the argument at the time was it was a heartless thing to do.
Yes.
And there was a lot of mockery around the phrase care in the community.
Oh, yeah.
What does that mean? It means pushing people out of proper care and pushing them onto the streets.
Yes, that's right.
Did they have a point?
Oh, there's a point to it, but the point really is not that point. The point politically was that the money should have followed the institutionalised people into the community services sector. And even today, that has not happened. You still see today people having to go back to hospitals for community-based care. That's an absolute scream. You know, why is it community-based care if it's based in a hospital? Makes no sense to me. But at that time, the reason it failed and the reason people keep saying, oh, those poor things on the streets, they should go back in the institution. Well, excuse me, if you've ever spent the time I have in an institution and I had the choice between living back there in that institution or under that sort of care and living in the streets, I'd pick the streets, thank you. They're safer.
So you didn't so much escape the institution escaped you, I suppose.
Yeah, they pushed me out because they wanted this to succeed, and we eventually, after this training, moved out into a flat in the community where there were four of us in a two-bedroom flat.
So when you say they, who are they?
The people running the rehab program in the hospital. And the reality is they offered us quite a bit of support in the first few years, and we made a relative success of it.
What state were you in when you got out of the hospital and got into a flat with some fellow former inmates? Is that the word?
Oh, well, colleagues.
Colleagues, yeah.
When we did get out, I had gotten myself a job. Mr. Smith, who was the patient who ran the hospital watchmaking business, he'd seen a job in the Sydney Morning Herald and applied for it with my name. And Mr. Smith got me a job working for Sydney Technical College. I got the job on the strength of Mr. Smith's application. And so I had started work. Now, this was so hilarious because I was drugged off my face trying to keep me to behave myself. And under so many major tranquilizers that I couldn't function, let alone work. It was all on the strength of me having worked, inverted commas, in the hospital library. So I got this job at Sydney Tech. And I slept all day on the floor of the staff room. And I remember the chief of my section calling me into her office one day and saying, oh, Janet, I have to say something to you. And, oh, yes, you know, talk about ignorance being bliss. And she said, you will not be getting your increment. So this must have been after the six-month probation. So I'd slept for 6 months on this job. I didn't know what that job was about. And she wasn't going to give me my increment because I really ought to do some work. And if I wanted to get the next increment, perhaps I should consider doing a couple of hours work each day. This came as a terrible shock. How am I going to do this? And I remember going back to the doctor and saying, she said to me I had to work, and she said, well, you should be. I didn't realise you weren't working. So, oh dear, they really understood rehab at that Sydney Tech at the time. And so I started doing a couple of hours work and then more and more and more until actually I got to do a 7 hour a day job, which was quite amazing.
Janet, so you're recovering really through this time then, are you?
I think it was all part of recovery, yes.
So really, what does it then take you to manage your recovery and make sure you don't have another episode? Does it really mean avoiding stress then? Does it just mean looking after yourself?
No. It means none of those things, really. They might contribute to it. I think what recovery really means is learning to understand why your mind is doing this sort of thing and then taking whatever it takes in the way of psychotherapy or cognitive behavioural therapy or medication or a combination of all that to actually understand, to perceive how your function is and what is normal behaviour and what isn't, and only allowing yourself to do the normal. That is a discipline, and that is something that takes years to refine, but recovery is really hard work. And it's an everyday thing. You can't let up.
You do that kind of cognitive therapy where you now have the ability to stand outside a kind of train of thought that's not helpful to you.
Yes.
And then look, identify that and go, oh, that's where that's going. I can see that. And it's a bit like, I don't know, being a Zen Buddhist master or something, isn't it, Janet? You know, this
well, it's
this,
a recovery mistress in my case. And I think we let everybody down who has a mental illness if we do not give them the opportunities to learn more about their brain activity, function and expression in order for them to take control of some of the things that are happening to them. I think that's what we really have to aim for. And we just seem interested in throwing tablets down people's necks without any learned behavioural control.
Is that the hard part of it, really?
The hard part is getting person in a form of treatment that suits them for long enough to really be able to show them that there's a new way, a further way to take you through this. You don't have to be handicapped for the rest of your life.
You were very involved in the closure of Gladesville Mental Hospital. Tell me about that time.
Oh, there were moments of minor triumph personally, and I've never really said this before, but during some of the nurses' strikes, and there was a certain sympathy for them in me, but the irony was, when I volunteered to assist, one of the wards I was volunteered into was one of the wards I had been a patient in. I was the senior volunteer who was maintaining that ward for a couple of nights. And I thought, there's a sublime irony in this, that maybe the lunatics are taking over the asylum.
Yeah, I got there half a second behind you there with that line. You've begun your own family too.
Not long after I was freed of my institutional trappings, I met my husband, who he is now. He was keener than I was on getting married. However, he convinced me that it was a reasonable thing to do, and we got married and a few years later had a son. That son's now a very lovely young man, married and about to give us a beautiful grandchild, hopefully, through his wife, Kathy. We're really proud of them, and they have been a great support. And particularly my son has been a wonderful support to me through my ups and downs.
Now you're advising the federal government, so you're part of a body to advise the federal government on mental health issues. What do you really want government to understand? What do you really want them to get?
I really want people anywhere, governments particularly, to understand that we need quality systems of care and that nobody's treatment or care should be damaging to them. Do unto others as you would have done unto you. So when there's money to be handed out, hand out the money to those systems of care that prove that they're humane, number one, and that they're empowering to the individual who's undergoing the most devastating experience in their life. There's no other disorder, no other disability, no other anything that takes away your self-esteem, your job, your credibility, your income, your status, your education, and takes you down to the lowest possible common denominator. And there's nothing worse than to be deemed by the world to be mad. You have no credibility, you have no voice, you have nothing that the society wants, and people would rather you be dead than alive. We've got to turn that round so that we're really proud of those who struggle with mental illness. We're proud of their journey, we're proud of their achievements, and we're really proud to see them part of a contributing Australia. And until that happens, I'll still go, and they'll probably cart me out, still spruiking the same thing. I don't care. I've been given another taste of life, and this life is given to me to change a system that's inhumane, that's disrespectful of human rights, and that doesn't give people every possible opportunity.
You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler. Broadcast, podcast, and online.
I spoke to Janet Marr in 2009, and even though Janet's now supposed to be retired, she's working with the Independent Advisory Council on the National Disability Insurance Scheme.
Getting your head straight's hard.
For everyone.
Especially when you're young.
This week the ABC's
talking about mental health.
Mental health affects everyone.
Maybe indirectly.
Probably directly.
It might be you.
Your friends. Or your family.
I just feel really low sometimes, not really for any reason, and that's what makes it the hardest. But at one point it was too much, and I went to a counsellor. It was the best thing I ever did.
Whatever the situation,
there is help available.
For more information, head to abc.net.au/mentalas.
Thank you for downloading this podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.